On September 30th, there was a coup attempt in Ecuador. The attempt was unsuccessful. This is Stephen Kinzer.
No matter how fully you can tell the story of any one of these operations, the only way you really understand the story is if you pull back and don't look at these coups and interventions as a series of unrelated episodes. Once you begin to look at the whole picture, and you look at these interventions as part of a continuum, patterns emerge, and particularly for me, they emerge over this question of why did we do it? Why did we carry out a particular intervention?
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll talk with Stephen Kinzer about U.S. involvement with coups in Latin America. We also talk with local Portland organizer Pedro Sosa about U.S. involvement in Guatemala. Stay tuned.
We start off with Wayne Madsen describing the coup attempt in Ecuador.
What we see in the case of Ecuador is similar to what happened to Chavez. After he was ousted briefly, he was taken to an island offshore Venezuela. There was a U.S. registered airplane sitting on the runway ready to take him into exile. We saw that happen to Aristide in 2004. A U.S. plane did fly him to Bangui in the Central African Republic and ultimately to South Africa. So I think the thing that's with the coup attempt against Rafael Correa in Ecuador is the fact that there was a crossfire at the police hotel between police mutineers and the army that came in to rescue him. That could have easily turned into an Allende-type situation with live fire. In the case of Ecuador, Venezuela, Haiti, and Honduras, these were left-leaning leaders. The U.S., the State Department and the CIA and Langley, seem to think that the Monroe Doctrine is still in effect, where Latin America has basically said the Monroe Doctrine that gives the United States the right to influence affairs in the Western Hemisphere is now null and void as far as they're concerned. That message doesn't seem to be conveyed to the CIA or the State Department or the Bush administration and now the Obama administration.
I'm Stephen Kinzer. I'm a longtime foreign correspondent. I worked for more than 20 years for the New York Times, most of it in foreign countries. And since leaving the Times about 10 years ago, I've dedicated myself to writing, including publishing a number of books, and I also write a column for The Guardian, contribute to The Daily Beast, and teach international relations at Boston University.
We wanted to start out talking with you about the recent coup attempt in Ecuador.
It seems to me that little disturbance we had in Ecuador, which did amount to some kind of a threat to President Correa, was more of a spontaneous eruption of emotion based on a conflict between certain groups in the security forces and the president. It escalated into kind of a macho moment. I'm not sure really if there was a political motivation behind it. Nonetheless, I think it does show that institutions in a number of Latin American countries are still weak. One of the reasons why there's such an appeal for new leftist-type leaders in the Chavez and Evo Morales mold is that the old political systems, the two-party systems in most cases, really only served as a facade behind which the elite of society dominated politics. People who looked like Evo Morales or Hugo Chavez had very little opportunity to rise in traditional politics in those countries. So the whole models in those countries had to be changed, and in that process, institutions which were weak beforehand have now developed a new set of weaknesses. So we're still in a transition period in some Latin American countries to institutions that can both maintain their credibility in society and also legitimately represent majorities. We're not quite there yet, and I think that's one thing Ecuador showed us.
I had read an article on the Global Research website that they were also talking about some money that's been infused into Ecuador, and they drew the conclusion that it followed patterns of other disturbances that have been coup attempts or covert action in other countries.
Well, just to finish up on Ecuador, what you say is actually quite true. There is oftentimes more below the surface than you can see in episodes like this. And in Ecuador, there is a particular piece of background. The United States had its largest military base in South America, in Ecuador, out on the coast at Manta. That was a base by which U.S. monitored drug traffic throughout that whole region. And, of course, when you're monitoring drug traffic in the air, you're able to monitor whatever else is in the air around there. So that was an important base for the United States. And when President Correa came to power over American objections, he closed it. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the United States would be taking a retaliatory action that we haven't yet known about, although, of course, that's always possible. Nonetheless, I think it would have planted in the minds of some people, perhaps in the security forces in Ecuador, that if they did strike against this guy, there would be American support ultimately on their side. Actually, they could draw some inspiration from what happened in Honduras not so long ago when a group of people tried an unconstitutional coup and were essentially encouraged from the United States, and the president they overthrew was never allowed to take office again. Now, what would lead people who have coups in mind in Latin America or elsewhere to believe that the United States might come to their aid? Well, that goes back over more than 100 years of American intervention in foreign governments. In my book, Overthrow, I go through 14 times that the United States has overthrown a foreign government. I start with Hawaii back in 1893, which, of course, was an independent kingdom when the United States supported a group of white planters and their allies in a revolution against the Queen and brought Hawaii into the United States. Then this pattern follows through the Spanish-American War when we seized the Philippines and Cuba and Puerto Rico, up through the Central American stage of American expansionism. Then we had, of course, the CIA interventions. And I don't go through all the interventions, but I just talk about the times when we actually overthrew governments. And the CIA did that at least four times. First time in Iran, when we overthrew Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1953 for the sin of trying to nationalize his country's oil. Then the next year we did the same thing in Guatemala, where an elected government was trying to nationalize unused land owned by the United Fruit Company. A little while later, in 1963, we overthrew President Diem in Vietnam. That was probably the only time we'd overthrown a leader who we had ourselves put in power. And then 10 years later, the CIA also was deeply involved in the overthrow of President Allende in Chile. After that era, the CIA era, we move into the final era, which is sort of back to Plan A when we would intervene with troops. And that takes you through Panama and Grenada up to larger interventions like Afghanistan and Iraq. So what this all means is that the idea that the U.S. is going to be intervening in foreign countries violently to overthrow their regimes and put in new regimes is not something that just originated with the administration of George Bush and has continued to now. It's something that's deeply woven into our approach to the world.
Would you mind going a little bit more into the recent coup in Honduras that happened last June?
What happened in Honduras, again, reflects institutional weakness. And I'd like to talk just a little bit about Honduras and how Honduras of today got to be the Honduras of today. Honduras was a very weak state that was dominated by an American visionary banana planter and agricultural pioneer, a man named Sam Zamuri. He organized coups in Honduras to make sure that he was given large amounts of land. He was called the uncrowned king of Central America, and he really was. So you had an American private entrepreneur essentially dominating Honduras in the early part of the 20th century. Honduras always remained under the thumb of large American agricultural companies. It's really the quintessential banana republic. Then another terrible thing happened. Honduras managed to escape a lot of overt violence, although it did remain very poor over all that period. Nonetheless, during the 1980s, when the United States was fighting its war against the Sandinista regime in next-door Nicaragua, we used Honduras as a base for the Contras, who were fighting against the Sandinistas. As a result of this, we introduced a huge military and security-oriented culture into Honduras. We poured hundreds of millions of dollars of military equipment into a country that had never had anything like this on the security side. And during this period, a military unit that was trained by the CIA is now known to have kidnapped and killed over 100 Honduran dissidents. This was the kind of thing that had never happened before in previous eras in Honduras. At the same time, that violence that was brought into Honduras by the American Contra Project produced a huge outflow of Honduran citizens who fled, and most of them wound up in the United States, the largest number of them in Southern California and particularly in Los Angeles. A whole generation of them grew up in this gang culture in Los Angeles. And then at the end of the 1980s, when those Central American wars calmed down, the United States slowly began sending those Hondurans back to Honduras. That brought this gang culture back to Honduras, and that has been hugely destabilizing for Honduras. President Zelaya, before he was overthrown, in one of his speeches, called the gang problem in Honduras a bigger problem for us than terrorism. And it really is. It's something that has devastated Honduran society. So all of this trouble that Honduras has faced in its history is really a result of outside intervention, and that's, of course, coming almost exclusively from the United States. Now, there have been Honduran rulers who have emerged who have been progressive-minded, and Zelaya, although he wasn't really elected with the idea that he was left-leaning, did develop that way while he was in office. He began towards the end of his term to express admiration for Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. He started promoting social reforms. He also began thinking about trying to arrange for a change in the Constitution so he could run for another term. I think some of his actions might have aroused legitimate fears in some quarters. On the other hand, he did nothing to justify what actually happened, which was a rebellion against his leadership. I found that very troubling because I think that you can weigh the good and bad sides of a lot of leaders. And sometimes leaders do things that are unwise or that could be destabilizing. But what's really destabilizing is when you strike against an elected government. We really need to get to the point, especially in Central America, where a government that has been freely elected should be allowed to complete its term. And to me, Zelaya's possible errors in judgment, which I think he made some, are not really the important thing here. The fact is, he was the elected leader of the country, and although he may have displeased some people, he had not done anything overtly unconstitutional, and it was most distressing to see that although the United States was kind of feckless and didn't know whether to support Zelaya, there were sort of pressures on both sides, that some conservative members of Congress jumped to the defense of this group that had overthrown the Honduran government. And the reason was that the new group was much more pro-American. So for these people, I guess their argument would be, what's really important in a foreign country, what we should support, is a government that's pro-U.S. And we should not be supporting a government just based on whether it was freely elected or whether it seized power in a coup. That's not important. The only thing that's important is the political tone of that government. And if that's going to be the policy, then we really are going back to the Cold War era.
You are listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO Portland, where we are discussing a history of coups with author Stephen Kinzer. Next, we ask him what similarities he sees between this most recent coup and coups of the past in relation to the U.S. government and U.S. corporations' involvement.
Years ago, I wrote a book called Bitter Fruit about the coup in which the CIA overthrew the government of Guatemala in 1954. After I wrote that book, I really felt good. I thought, boy, you've told the whole story of how it happened now, and you've ripped away the veil of lies, and you've shown the whole truth about who was involved and what they did. Actually, after a while, as often happens when you begin to feel satisfied with yourself, it began to dawn on me that I hadn't really told the whole story, because no matter how fully you can tell the story of any one of these operations, the only way you really understand the story is if you pull back and don't look at these coups and interventions as a series of unrelated episodes. Once you begin to look at the whole picture, and you look at these interventions as part of a continuum, patterns emerge, and particularly for me, they emerge over this question of why did we do it? Why did we carry out a particular intervention? In almost every case, it has to do with the desire of the United States to have access to some kind of market or some kind of resource that the government of country X does not want to concede to us, at least not on the terms that we want to offer. So you can trace this pattern over various interventions. Look at the Spanish-American War to begin with. So this was, of course, in 1898. Very briefly, the story of our intervention was that America got very carried away with the cause of the Cuban Revolution against the decadent Catholic Spanish monarchy. We offered to send troops to help the Cuban revolutionaries. The revolutionaries weren't so sure. They wanted to have a lot of American troops since they were on the verge of winning their war anyway. So the United States passed a law promising the Cubans that we would withdraw immediately after the victory over Spain. Once we promised that, the Cubans invited us to send troops in. The Spanish were indeed, in just a few days of fighting, pushed out of Cuba. And then we changed our mind. Even though we had promised that we would withdraw, we decided we were going to keep Cuba. Why did we renege on our promise, explicitly expressed in U.S. law, in a law called the Teller Amendment, to give Cuba its independence? It's because after the Spanish were thrown out of Cuba, it suddenly became clear to us that the Cuban revolutionaries actually had a program of their own. They didn't just want to fight to get the Spanish out. They had their own political ideas. One of their political ideas was that land should be given to every landless Cuban family. Where are they going to get that land? They're going to break up the big sugar plantations. Who owns the big sugar plantations? Americans and allies of the Americans. So suddenly the United States began to think, boy, maybe giving this country independence isn't such a good idea after all. Then came the discovery that the Cuban incoming revolutionary government also wanted to encourage Cuban manufacturing by putting a tariff wall around Cuba so that imported goods would be much more expensive in Cuba. But who exported most of Cuba's goods? Of course, the United States. 90% of the manufactured goods in Cuba were coming from the United States. So, if this tariff wall were erected, American companies would lose a big market in Cuba. So it was these factors, the fear of losing the land from the sugar plantations and the fear of losing markets in Cuba, that led the United States to renege on its promise to allow Cuban independence. We kept Cuba as a protectorate. Then we ruled it indirectly through a series of pliant dictators. And the result was the Cuban Revolution, in which Fidel Castro came to power. If we had not reneged on our pledge to give Cuba independence originally, we would have never had to confront Fidel Castro. That whole phenomenon might never even have occurred. So that's just one example. We then follow that up, two more classic examples to summarize them. One is, of course, Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. The Arbenz government was an elected, popular government in Guatemala. The greatest national problem in Guatemala was lack of land, but there were huge tracts of land in Guatemala that were owned by United Fruit Company and that United Fruit Company was not using. They were just holding it so that no competition could ever emerge for them from some other banana company, and that the peasants of Guatemala wouldn't have land of their own, and then they wouldn't need to come over and work on the United Fruit plantations as migrant workers. So the government of Guatemala, through a constitutional vote of Congress, passed a law allowing the government to expropriate unused land and set the rate of compensation. United Fruit Company protested to the White House. It was intimately connected with the White House during that period. United Fruit Company's former lawyer, John Foster Dulles, was the Secretary of State at the time. And the Arbenz government was painted as a communist threat to the United States in a coup set in motion by this land reform law, and that government was overthrown. That whole process never would have started if it hadn't been for the conflict over United Fruit and its land and the access to banana crops in Guatemala. And it was that coup that has set Guatemala on this path to the terrible violence that it faces in its society today.
Do you have any comments on that recent apology of people who were experimented on with syphilis in Guatemala?
It really raised to me this thought about poor Guatemala. Is there anything that we have not done to Guatemala? I mean, it really, this is a country that has a legitimate reason to resent what the United States has done. That country broke out of traditional dictatorship in 1944 through a peaceful revolution led by school teachers demonstrating in the street, inspired above all by their great hero, Franklin Roosevelt. They elected a government after overthrowing the dictatorship. That government lasted for 10 years. They had a democratic government for 10 years, but because of its nationalist desire to control its territory and not allow United Fruit to control it, that government was overthrown. That was the end of democracy in Guatemala. Then, of course, there was an uprising against the new military regime, and that lasted for 30 years. The number of Guatemalans killed was in the hundreds of thousands during that period. It was more people than were killed in all the rest of Latin America combined in insurgencies and repressions. Forget Chile, forget Argentina, forget El Salvador. Guatemala towered over them all. It was a charnel house. That lasted for over a generation. And finally, with the war ended, the peace is turning out also to be intensely violent. Guatemala has one of the highest murder rates in the hemisphere, and something like 1 or 2% of murders are ever solved. One UN investigator there called it the murderer's paradise. We introduced this whole culture of military rule in Guatemala, and this military rule was so extreme that it was essentially based on death squads who went out and killed thousands of Mayan peasants as well as anybody joining labor unions and other kinds of organizations. This was a political culture that was encouraged by the United States. That was the regime that we had put in power. So people learned that this is the way to resolve disputes. This is the culture they saw around them. And then finally, the regime became so weak, this post-war regime, that drug gangs have taken over large parts of Guatemala, and it's become a main part of the smuggling route to the United States. That has greatly weakened the reach of government. And Guatemala is, in some ways, approaching the status of a failed state. So much of this is traced back to America's refusal to allow Guatemala to develop on its own capitalist, nationalist course back in the 1950s, and then the imposition of this terribly brutal military rule during the 60s and 70s and 80s. So when I read the apology that we had also actually intentionally injected syphilis into Guatemalan patients back in the 1940s, I thought, what else is left to be revealed about what we have done to those poor Guatemalans? I hope that maybe it will, if nothing else, trigger some people's desire to see if we can't work a little more closely with Guatemala and take that as a great priority for us in that part of the world.
That was Stephen Kinzer.
We now talk with local organizer Pedro Sosa of the American Friends Service Committee.
We start out by asking the community's response to the recent U.S. apology issued to Guatemalans in regards to syphilis testing previously done in Guatemala.
The first reaction we have is, how many other experiments been doing with us? This is just one we know so far, but how many more? They talk a lot about other health issues. Is that something, experiment being done, or our question also about the vacunas,
you know? The vaccines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's lots of things come to our mind when we saw that. I think this is a crime but it's not resolved with just an apologize. It's a crime, and has to be, how do you say, take it to the court to do something, because as a community, we were affected. It's interesting because the syphilis happened at the same time when the coup happened in Guatemala. They did it with our health, and also they did it with the support of the army and, of course, the CIA behind this. What happened in the 54 when Arbenz was a victim of the coup? It's because the government or the USA thinks it has to do with the communists, and they made the connection with the Unión Soviética.
The Soviet Union.
And also because in this time, lots of reforma agraria, how do you call that?
Land reform.
Yeah, land reform, and one of the things, it's the Decreto 800, Decree 800, it's to give the land to the people. And that's when the United Fruit Company didn't like that, and that's when they prepare the coup from Honduras, from El Salvador, and they came to Guatemala. They were divided into four groups to enter in Guatemala, but two of them, they couldn't go forward because the Guatemalan army stopped them, and some of them, just they ran away to El Salvador or Honduras. Just two of them, they use lots of tactics to scare the community, like bombing. The government of Guatemala thought that this is a big thing. And when many of the army get scared, and finally the government has to resign his position because of this. But I think they didn't have the power, but they used more scare tactics in order to finish the government of...
So it was really a terror campaign against the people of Guatemala and the government. So then what happened after that?
After that, I think Guatemala changed a lot. But now some people still in the Costa, they remember that 10 years of democracy, the lands. Some of the people were organized and they had some of those lands, and they remember now. But they already older. But after that, several of coup happened. And I remember in the 80s when Rios Montt did the coup, we couldn't go out. We have to be at home. We couldn't exercise our constitutional rights. Free speech, and lots of people were disappeared and killed in those decades.
I think that Rios Montt was known for a scorched earth policy, is what they called it, and he was responsible for genocide in many of the indigenous villages in Guatemala. Is that true?
Yes, yes. In Romeo Lucas, Mejia Victores, Rios Montt, and now Rios Montt, he is in Congress. Rigoberta Menchú sued him, but he's still in the government. He is in Congress right now.
And during the time when he was actually the president of Guatemala, was the U.S. supporting him?
Yeah, lots of head of the army in Guatemala got the training in the U.S., and also some U.S. soldiers trained them in Guatemala.
How does it feel for you as a Guatemalan to see the U.S.'s foreign policy all over Latin America?
We thought we won't see more in this new era, but we still see that. The experience in Honduras last year and just a few weeks ago in Ecuador, you know, the intent of a coup in Ecuador. And we feel like it's still the same. Our question is, when we're going to live in peace? We, as a community, we wanted to live in peace. We don't want it more this kind of intervention. No more coup. We wanted to exercise our rights. We want to live in peace.
Some of the work that you do in the United States is really based around immigrant rights, and part of helping people understand why people have been forced to come to the United States.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing many people don't understand, why we immigrate to the United States. We were forced to leave our country. We're forced to leave because we can't live anymore because this the civil war, economy, and the intervention of other countries in our country, the poor become more poor and the richest become more rich. And that's one of the reasons the people in the United States need to understand why we emigrate. Because now as immigrant in this country, we feel the anti-immigrant sentiments, and they wanted to throw us to our country. But we have a history. They need to understand we didn't come here just for fun. We come here because we couldn't live anymore in Guatemala or in Central America or in other country because the civil war or the poverty. We're trying to save our life. And that's why we are here and we're still struggling. We need recognition. We need to live with dignity. We need to live in peace. Our question, like, as refugees, as immigrants, where is the place where we can live in peace? Because in our country, the government chasing the community, chasing us. When we come to the U.S., the immigration, the anti-immigrant sentiments, anti-immigrant law, chasing us. Where are we going to live in peace? We are tired to live this way.
And what about the situation in Guatemala now?
I think after the government and the UNRG signed the peace accord, change a little bit, but I think the violence still the same. It's another way of violence. The people still living in fear, con miedo, and it changed a little bit, but still, it's not a civil war, but it's still a violence where the people has to emigrate, has to leave the country.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the U.S. owes Guatemala and other countries that it's changed the course of their history by intervening some kind of reparations? Or is that something that people talk about?
I think besides the reparation, I think they had to return whatever they took from our land, the resources. They said we had the external debt. They said we have millions of external debt. But if we see the reality, if we make numbers to see how much they took from our land, if they paid interest of these resources, they took it, who owe the money? Not the community, not our country, not our people. They owe us. But ellos son sinvergüenzas. They tell us we owe them. Mm-hmm. It's not true. They owe us.
Is there anything that you want to add as we're shining a spotlight on Latin America and U.S. foreign policy?
I wanted to make a call to the community in the USA. We are human beings. We have to live as a human being. This way of living, we have to end it. We have to educate our legislator. We have to educate our government. We deserve peace. We deserve dignity. All of us should live with dignity. We have to finish this. To do that as a community, we have to educate ourselves about what happened in other countries. We have to educate our legislator. We have to educate our government to end this. But we have to do that because nobody else is going to do it for us.
That was Pedro Sosa of the American Friends Service Committee.
You are listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are investigating the history of coups in Latin America. We now return to our discussion with Stephen Kinzer.
The United States has traditionally believe that it is entitled to a certain percent of the world's resources, and that we have the right to determine, A, what percent that is, and B, what are fair terms that we should arrange in order to receive that percentage. So when other countries don't agree with that, that causes conflicts, and those conflicts lie behind many American interventions in foreign countries.
I believe you've spoken before Congress on this subject of interventions before, is that true?
met with members of Congress, among others, but I've done a lot of speaking on this subject, of course.
So I'm just curious what the efforts are to put this kind of covert and overt intervention in check in our political system here.
Before you can decide to change or modify the tactics of intervention, I think you have to deal with the larger problem of interventionism as a phenomenon. It has to do with redefining the ambition of the United States in the modern age. Successful nations are able to adapt as the world changes over time. The United States actually has not been around for very long, and history has not yet been able to make a verdict as to whether the U.S. will prove to be an adaptable power that can change as times change. Right now, much of our foreign policy is still stuck in an old traditional mindset. We had this conventional, confrontation-oriented foreign policy that we used during the Cold War. The Cold War has been over for 20 years now, yet the United States maintains more than 700 military bases around the world, and we are still considering ourselves the power that has to be at the center of every dispute, confrontation, project anywhere in the world. Before we can start to think about whether the CIA will still be launching coups or whether there's going to be an increase in the use of drone aircraft for targeted killings, we have to ask this larger question of whether the United States is still going to be so aggressively involved in so many places in such a heavy way, so far away from home. It's a question of what the United States wants to be in the 21st century. Unfortunately, rethinking our approach to whole vital regions of the world is not something that the United States foreign policy establishment does very well. We have some pathologies in our domestic politics that discourage original thinking in foreign policy and diplomacy. We need to break out of old assumptions and paradigms and realize that in this new century, the United States can still play an important role. But if we try to overplay our role, we're going to wind up causing problems worse than the ones we set out to solve. This is another pattern you often see as a result of American interventions. When we go out to carry out an intervention, we're usually able to accomplish what we want in the short run. For example, overthrow Saddam Hussein. We have that kind of military power. But when we look back over a period of years, we find out that we caused many problems more than we had anticipated, and sometimes find ourselves worse off than if we hadn't intervened. Many of these interventions wind up being terrible, not just for the target country, but also because they undermine American national security. And often it takes many years for the results of these interventions to become clear, but they often wind up harming us as much as they harm the target country.
Would you like to speak on the role of the media in creating the circumstances that allow these coups or interventions to be sold to the people of our country?
Media is an overwhelming influence on people in our age. It certainly has been a factor in promoting American intervention. A classic case is the Spanish-American War and the sinking of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor. That was the episode that killed over 200 American fighters aboard that ship. You can see, actually I reproduce in my book, Overthrow, the front page of Hearst's newspaper, the New York Journal, the next day. And it says, destruction of the Maine was the work of an enemy. They even have a diagram on the top of the front page of the Maine with the water line and then how the Spaniards had attached the mines underneath the hull of the Maine and then where the cables from the mine had been laid to the detonators. All of this was fantasy. It took the U.S. Navy 70 years before they convened a true investigation. It was when Jimmy Carter was president, to find out who really did sink the Maine. And it turned out that the Maine was sunk by a spark set off by a boiler next to the powder room inside the ship itself. And Spain had nothing to do with it. Nonetheless, outrage that the Spanish would blow up one of our ships and kill 200 of our boys helped send us off to war. So it served a very convenient purpose. Later on, Americans were conditioned, I think, by Western movies in ways that I think predispose us, or maybe just reflect our impulse to go out and make and purify the world in ways that we think are going to work. Think of what is the paradigm of that classic Western. You've got a town where gangsters or bad people have taken over. And an honest person can't live there. You can't raise a decent family there because you're being terrorized by a few thugs. And then one good man with a gun shows up. Nobody has appointed this guy. He's just acting out of his noble, self-propelled desire to cleanse the world. So he goes in, and by just shooting a few people, he then cleanses that environment. He makes everything perfect again. And then he doesn't ask for anything in return. And in fact, he sacrifices himself in order to help these people, asks for nothing, and then rides away in the sunset. This creates a self-image, I think, in the mind of Americans, that that's what we do in the world, that we're totally selfless. All we do is go out and kill a few bad guys, because in these countries like Iraq, this is the fantasy I think Americans learn from the media. Everybody is naturally pro-American. Why wouldn't they be? We're so good. We're so helpful to everyone. But some countries are anti-American because they've been hijacked by a few thugs like Saddam Hussein, who turned this naturally friendly and loving pro-American country into a snarling enemy of the United States. So we're going to go and get that guy. We go over there and take out Saddam and a few of his thugs, and then everything's going to be fine again. That's the paradigm that we get from these movies. We don't understand that culture is much deeper than that, and that Americans have histories in those countries that means it's not just a few thugs that don't like us, but we've given reason to people over there not to like us. So in the more modern age, I think you see the press also playing a role, because above all, we allow government to set the agenda. Government does not tell reporters what to write, but government does have a great ability to tell reporters what to write about. It's government that sets the agenda. If you want to go off that agenda as a reporter, you might find some editor saying to you, but that's a subject nobody's talking about. Nobody in Washington is interested in that. But the fact is, we should not be governed as journalists by what Washington thinks is important. When the press gets sucked into the official debate, it denies broader options. We tend to accept the narrow paradigms of acceptable behavior. This is especially true in foreign affairs. Any original thinking about the role of the United States in the world and reconceiving what the United States should be and do in the world is looked at with great suspicion. You must accept a whole group of basic accepted principles of U.S. foreign policy. Otherwise, you are viewed as the bringer of some terrible and threatening plague that might affect the entire policy process. So this pressure narrows the debate in Washington, and the media should be playing the role of broadening that debate. Too often, the media accepts that what Washington is talking about and debating is the most important stuff facing our country. And anything that's not really being talked about or taken seriously by members of Congress and think tank activists can't really be very important. It's not our job to do that. The press should always be trying to shape its own agenda, not accepting the agenda that power sets.
How that plays out with the big newspapers or broadcast news is that certain labels for leaders of other countries are taken for granted. The strong man, the dictator, and the people who are writing or telling these stories repeat without analyzing from a different perspective why they're using these words.
I've got an even better one. You named some good ones. But my favorite one of all that is repeatedly dragged out is the new Hitler. we're always trying to escalate this. And I sometimes ask myself if this is a trait peculiar to Americans. There are some other nations besides the United States that have this view that the world is full of enemies and everybody out there wishes us ill and we've got to be on the aggressive all the time to make sure that they don't come to get us. But I think Americans in particular do not like to be or find it difficult to be against something diffuse like an ideology or a force or a group. There's something in our nature, maybe it's our individualistic culture, that makes us really need to have an individual to focus on. Media drumbeats for intervention in war always seem to succeed better in the United States if they are accompanied with a particular individual who can be built up into this Hollywood casting model of the demon, the hateful other that threatens our hearth and home. We've seen this repeatedly. We went through Castro and Mao Zedong. We had Arafat for a while. There was Gaddafi until he changed his stripes. Saddam Hussein, of course. We have now Ahmadinejad. Chavez has played this role. We are very quick to whip up a demon. And there's something maybe in the American psyche that makes us very vulnerable to that trope. We seem to think that an individual can arise, but yet if he's anti-American or threatening to the United States, he cannot also be legitimate in the eyes of his own people. We've got this sense that anybody that doesn't like us in the world must fit into one of two categories. Either it's someone that doesn't know us, that doesn't know how benevolent we are, or, on the other hand, it's actually a bad person, an evil person who naturally wouldn't like us because we're good. The other possibility never occurs to us, the possibility that there could be good, decent, patriotic, nationalistic people in many parts of the world who legitimately know us well and know what we've done but don't like what we've done and don't like what we do. This is something that's difficult for Americans to grasp. It contradicts our self-image, and neuroscientists tell us that our brain is hardwired not to accept sensory information that conflicts with the stereotypical boxes and tropes, the paradigms that we already have inside our mind. So maybe this is what makes it difficult for the U.S. to think that there could be any substantial number of people out there in the world who, with very good motivations and for very good reasons, could be very angry at us.
That was Stephen Kinzer. You are listening to Circle A Radio.
At the last Summit of the Americas in Trinidad, there were a lot of elected officials there, democratically elected officials there, who had also been tortured or lost family members due to U.S. intervention policies. And Hugo Chavez gave a copy of The Open Veins of Latin America to Obama. On the heels of that meeting, we saw that there might be some softening on the policies with Cuba. And when Obama was campaigning, we heard that we would have NAFTA renegotiated. Can you give us your ideas about how Obama's done? Has our foreign policy shifted off course at all of these last 100 years of overthrowing other countries and operating in the interests of U.S. business?
There's no doubt that American foreign policy is and probably will remain intimately connected to our desire to maintain markets and maintain access to resources in other parts of the world, particularly Latin America. Intrinsically, when you have weaker societies and weaker governments, they're more open to penetration by foreign power, including foreign economic power. Nonetheless, we've seen something very interesting in Latin America, particularly in South America, over the last generation. And I don't think it's something that people expected. The United States was very heavily pushing this so-called Washington Consensus, that everyone in Latin America should understand that now the Cold War is over and the liberal economic policies and the free trade agreements and the globalization policies that the U.S. was promoting were really the only way to go for Latin America. But during that period, over the last 20 years, some very important nationalist movements grew and had tremendous effect in the political mainstream of many countries. You're absolutely right that in some countries you even had people who had been tortured or abused in some way by regimes illegitimately imposed partly by the United States, now rising to positions of power. In fact, the favored candidate to become successor to Lula as president of Brazil falls into this category. She, too, was arrested and abused during the Brazilian military dictatorship that was supported by the United States. Now, during these last 20 years, a series of governments have emerged in Latin America that in various ways are challenging the old pattern of United States hegemony. One question you might ask is, why did this happen? The United States has always made it clear that we didn't want those kinds of regimes to emerge. And this is not the first time nationalist regimes with this anti-American tints have emerged in Latin America. It's happened before, but in the past we never tolerated it. We never allowed it to grow, certainly not to the stage that it's at now. So what was the difference? Well, I'll tell you what might be one difference. One time, a couple of years after the Iraq invasion, around 2005, while Iraq was in this terrible upheaval and people were being killed, bombs were going off all the time, I wrote a column in which I said that it's now clear that everybody lost the Iraq war. And I went through the whole list of how Iraq lost and the United States lost and Al-Qaeda lost and Saddam lost and so forth. So I got a couple of emails from a couple of friends of mine in Latin America, and they said, in a sort of a half-serious way, they said, you know something, your column was wrong. You said there were no winners in the Iraq War and in the years that followed. But we tell you something different. We Latin Americans were the winners. We were the only winners of the Iraq War. Because the fact that the United States was so totally focused on, we're going to destroy Saddam, then we're going to Afghanistan, we're going to crush the mullahs in Iran, then we're going after the Syrians, allowed us here in South America to get away with establishing kinds of governments that in the past the United States would never let us get away with. So maybe the fact that the U.S. can, in a foreign policy sense, not chew gum and walk at the same time, that it can't follow more than one part of the world at a time, was exactly what allowed these more nationalistic regimes to emerge in Latin America. So I hadn't thought of that when I wrote my column, but actually from a South American perspective, it is true that the time when these regimes were coming to power and consolidating themselves with large popular support in South America, the United States was totally preoccupied to the point of obsession with what was happening in the Middle East. So maybe that's not a coincidence, and maybe the fact that we were so focused on the Middle East, despite the terrible results that it had in the Middle East, did allow developments to unfold in Latin America that otherwise might not have unfolded.
I'm still interested to get a comment on Obama's foreign policy specifically.
Sure. I think it's clear that we've seen a change in tone toward Latin America. We haven't seen the kind of rhetoric or pushing around attitude that's been traditional from the White House. I think Obama has a very good image in Latin America. Nonetheless, we haven't seen any dramatic change in approach. I think the first thing that would signal a change would have to do with Cuba. It seems to me that the coalition is there. We've got these senators from Midwestern farm states who want to sell their wheat and corn to Cuba, leading the charge. And the Cuban community in Florida has now evolved to the point where it's no longer so rabidly opposed to normalization. I think there's some frustration with Obama for not having focused more on Latin America and specifically for not having changed relations with Cuba. I could see Cuba is really just ready for some creative diplomacy. What would Cuba do as part of the lifting of the U.S. embargo? And could that be part of confidence-building measures that could lead to something else? It's puzzling, I think, to me, why we haven't had some diplomats out trying to answer those questions. Perhaps that has to do with political realities inside the United States. But I think that in terms of our relations with Latin America, the change in tone, which is always welcome, has not really been underlined or matched with a change in substance.
I wanted to find out if there's things that you would like to share with our listening audience that we haven't touched upon.
One issue that I fear we may have to deal with in the years ahead is the mounting drug violence in Mexico. It may well be that there are forces in Mexico that have an interest in trying to increase tensions between Mexico and the United States. Given history, those tensions, I suppose, could heat up, and there's always a chance when countries border on each other that episodes can be used to inflame tensions on both sides and whip up calls for what amounts to intervention. We not only have drug violence, but we have anti-immigrant feelings in much of that southwestern part of the United States. If tensions escalate too high, there might be pressure from some quarters for some kind of, how would you use it as a euphemism, police action or some kind of armed aid or some other way that you could disguise American military action inside Mexico, which could would set off terrible reactions, of course. I hope that we try to manage the Mexico situation and don't allow that one to spiral out of hand. The one other challenge that I see, even more immediate and greater, and to me it's the number one challenge in Latin America, is Haiti. It truly is an outrage and an insult to the United States that we can have a country so close to our shores that is living in social conditions comparable to lower levels that you find in Africa. The American intervention may not be the sole cause. It certainly is not for all of Haiti's troubles. American intervention is one of a number of factors. Nonetheless, the fact is the United States has been intervening repeatedly in Haiti for well over a century. And number two fact, Haiti is in a desperate situation. These two facts cannot be totally unrelated. So for me, I would like to see some more intense global focus on how to right the situation in Haiti, because it is an affront to everybody living in the Western Hemisphere, and particularly to everybody living in the United States. So those are a couple of concerns that I think remain on the horizon. But what we really would like to see is a president who wanted personally to become more deeply involved in America's approach to Latin America. I suppose President Obama could legitimately claim that he's got a few other things on his mind. Nonetheless, for those of us that closely follow Latin America, we're still waiting for some of that change that we heard about during the last presidential campaign.
We'd like to thank our guests, Stephen Kinzer and Pedro Sosa, for speaking with us. Also, a local announcement. Sister Helen Prejean, peacemaker, abolitionist, Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and author of Dead Man Walking, will be the featured speaker at the First United Methodist Church, located at Southwest Jefferson and 18th, on October 21st at 4 p.m. For more information on this event, visit www.oadp.org.
Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. We can be contacted through the KBOO website at kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. You can listen to many of our past shows there. We can also be contacted through CircleA Radio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.